Chapter 19, Healing, Encouragement, and Deliverance. Printed in the Review and Herald, July 18, 1935. I believe that swelling on your eye will prove to be cancer. But you will not live long enough to be seriously troubled by that. You are in a dangerous condition with heart disease, and I believe cannot live more than 3 months. Thus did a celebrated physician, visiting Rochester in February 1854, diagnose the physical condition of Ellen White. He had offered medical counsel free, and she had gone to him to hear his opinion regarding a painful swelling in one of her eyes. This had begun to trouble her soon after her return from an Eastern trip in the autumn of 1853, and had increased in size till it was very large and painful, and she had been obliged to give up riding entirely for a time. To a friend on March 10, she wrote, "I have done nothing like work for 6 weeks. Disease of the heart is making rapid progress upon me, and unless I soon regain some strength of body and soul to rise above my fearful and threatening disease, I cannot continue long." You may inquire, "Has Sister White given up to die?" I answer, no. I still hope because others wish me to, and my faith is increasing that the enemy will not be permitted to triumph over me. But I have been sorely afflicted and have been brought very near death's door. A few days after writing this letter, she fainted and remained unconscious for a day and a half. Many earnest prayers were offered in her behalf, and she was revived. But a week later, while conversing with a member of the family, she had a stroke of paralysis affecting her left side. Thinking that she was about to die, she expressed her greatest desire to receive an assurance of God's love and to rise above the despondency and depression of spirits that had accompanied her suffering and weakness. Of the fulfillment of this desire, and of the unexpected blessing of complete healing, she has written, "The brethren and sisters came together to make my case a special subject of prayer. My desire was granted. Prayer was heard, and I received the blessing of God and had the assurance that He loved me. But the pain continued, and I grew more feeble every hour. The brethren and sisters again came together to present my case to the Lord. I was then so weak that I could not pray vocally. My appearance seemed to weaken the faith of those around me. Then the promises of God were arrayed before me as I had never viewed them before. It seemed to me that Satan was striving to tear me from my husband and children and lay me in the grave, and these questions were suggested to my mind. Can you believe the naked promise of God? Can you walk out by faith, let the appearance be what it may? Faith revived, I whispered to my husband, 'I believe that I shall recover.' He answered, 'I wish I could believe it.' I retired that night without relief, yet relying with firm confidence upon the promises of God. I could not sleep, but continued my silent prayer to God. Just before day, I slept. As I awoke, the rising sun was seen from my window. I was perfectly free from pain. The pressure upon my heart was gone, and I was very happy. I was filled with gratitude. The praise of God was upon my lips." The doctor had told her husband that one of the last indications of approaching death in the case of his wife would be a false supposition that she was well. Remembering this, he was not convinced, but rather alarmed when his wife awoke him exclaiming, "Father, Father, the Lord has healed me." Soon Sister Bonfoy, hearing the sound of excited voices, came to see what had occurred. As she came in, Mrs. White said, "I am healed, Clara. The Lord has healed me. Get me my clothes." Elder White groaned. He did not yet believe that his wife was healed. Mrs. White arose and dressed and praised the Lord for this new manifestation of His favor. The pain in her heart was gone. The pain in her eye was gone. At first, she did not think of the swelling on the eye, and when she did put her hand on the swelling, she found it decreased in size and not painful. In 3 weeks, it had entirely disappeared. In writing to a friend, April 11, 1854, she said, "The Lord has done for me that which no physician upon earth could do. It is about 3 weeks since I was healed, and my heart remains free from pain." Soon she again visited the physician who had declared that she could not live more than 3 months. He was astounded. He felt of her pulse and said, "Madam, you are better. An entire change has taken place in your system, but the two women who visited me for counsel when you were last here are dead." A sister who went with her on this visit to the physician told him, after Mrs. White had left his office, that God had heard prayer for her and healed her. In response, he declared, "Her case is a mystery. I do not understand it." Now that Mrs. White was stronger, a second visit to Michigan was planned. Appointments were printed in the review for meetings in Milan in northern Ohio and for Jackson, Sylvan, and Locke in southern Michigan, with a suggestion as to the possibility of going still farther west to Wisconsin. In the review of May 2, 1854, James White wrote, "Would it not be well for the scattered brethren to come together something on the plan of a camp meeting, bringing a trunk of provisions and a few bedclothes?" The meeting at Milan in northern Ohio, the first general gathering of believers in that state, was attended by about 40 people. Here, plans were laid for carrying forward aggressive work in Ohio. After this meeting, they took the boat from Sandusky to Detroit and continued the journey by train to Jackson, Michigan. Here was the first strong church that was raised up in Michigan. The Jackson Church had enjoyed the ministry of Joseph Bates from time to time since 1849, and for nearly 4 years had been liberal supporters of the cause, contributing freely to the publishing work and to traveling ministers. After 3 days spent in council with the brethren at Jackson, a meeting was held at Sylvan. The party, which now included J. N. Loughborough and M. E. Cornell, returned by train to Jackson and proceeded from there north to Locke. This journey of about 50 miles they made with horse and wagon. Much of the country was swampy, and to make a bed for the roadway, logs had been laid close together crosswise of the road and dirt heaped upon them. But in many places, the soil that had originally covered these logs had been washed away by the rains, and not only were the travelers obliged to drive very slowly much of the way, but they were badly bumped and shaken as they advanced over these corduroy roads. At Locke, the preaching brethren were made to realize that a new era was dawning for the proclamation of the message which they had for the world. Hitherto, most of the meetings had been held in private houses, in barns, in shops, or sometimes in district schoolhouses. For the meeting at Locke, the schoolhouse had been secured, but the people came out in such great numbers that the building could not hold half of them. Therefore, it was arranged for the speaker to stand in the window where he could be heard by those inside and also by the larger audience outside who were seated in their carriages and on the grass. The next day, as the company was driving to Sylvan and were rejoicing at the willingness of the public to hear their message, they also discussed plans for carrying on a more aggressive work. During this discussion, someone proposed the propriety of purchasing a large tent and pitching it for meetings. This suggestion met with favor, and Elder White expressed the opinion that by another year they might venture to raise money and purchase a tent. Elder Cornell said, "If the plan is good for next year, why not for this year?" Why should we not get a tent at once? The discussion was then renewed, and the more they talked about it, the more they felt impressed that they should act immediately in the matter of securing a tent. The preceding summer, two First-Day Adventist ministers had used a 60-foot circular tent with much success. Large audiences had attended the meetings, but a disagreement had arisen between the two men, and their efforts had been discontinued. Their tent was now lying idle in Rochester, and there was a prospect that it might be purchased at about half price. As the discussion proceeded, our brethren felt impressed that they should act immediately and secure this tent if possible. On their arrival at Sylvan, a settlement about halfway between Jackson and Ann Arbor, where there was a group of Sabbath keepers, they went to the home of Charles S. Glover. Without delay, they laid before Brother Glover the matter they had been discussing and asked his opinion regarding the purchase of a tent. In reply, he drew $35 from his pocket and said, "There is what I think of it." Thus encouraged, they hastened back to Jackson and laid the plan before D.R. Palmer, Serenius Smith, and J.P. Kellogg. These men were enthusiastic about securing a tent and made liberal gifts, and Brother Kellogg, in order to hasten the work, offered to lend what was necessary to make up the cost of the tent and take his pay when gifts came in. By noon of the next day, May 23, Elder Cornell was on his way east to buy the tent. Not often did the work move as rapidly as in the matter of getting and using this first tent. On Sunday, the large attendance of interested listeners at the schoolhouse had led to a consideration of the question of providing movable meeting accommodations. On Monday, brethren were visited, and funds were found for the purchase of a tent. Tuesday, Elder Cornell started for Rochester to make the purchase, and 18 days later, he and Elder Loughborough were holding meetings in it in Battle Creek. After bidding farewell to Elder Cornell at the eastbound train about noon, Elder and Mrs. White spent the remainder of the day at the home of Brother Palmer. They were to take the train for Wisconsin that evening. Of their forebodings of danger, J.N. Loughborough has written, "Several times during the afternoon, Brother White spoke and said, 'I feel strangely in regard to starting on this trip, but Ellen, we have an appointment out, and we must go.' Once, he said, 'With my feelings, if I had not an appointment, I should not go tonight.' As night came on, near the time of the arrival of the train, we had a season of prayer. All seemed led out to pray for the safety of Brother and Sister White on this journey. As we arose, Brother White expressed his faith that the Lord would have a care for them and keep them. At 8 o'clock, I went aboard the train with them to assist in getting on their parcels. We went into one car with high back seats, called in those days a sleeping car. Sister White said, 'James, I can't stay in this car. I must get out of here.' I helped them in getting a seat in the middle of the next car. Sister White sat down with her parcel in her lap but said, 'I don't feel at home on this train.' The bell then rang, and I bade them goodbye. The cars had run about 3 miles from Jackson when their motion became very violent, jerking backward and forward, and finally stopped. I raised the window and saw a car standing upon one end and heard most distressing groans and great confusion. The engine had been thrown off the track, but the car we were in was on the track and was separated from those before it about 100 feet. The express car was crushed to pieces, the goods scattered, and many of them destroyed. The baggage car was not much injured, and our large trunk of books was safe. The second-class car was crushed, and the pieces with the passengers in it were thrown from the track on both sides of it. The car in which we tried to get a seat was much broken, and one end was raised upon the heap of ruins. The coupling did not break, but the cars separated as if an angel had unfastened them. Another train was expected in a few minutes, and the greatest excitement was raised. The broken pieces of the cars were used to build a large fire, and men with torches went upon the track in the direction the cars were expected. We hastily left the car, and my husband took me in his arms and carried me, wading in the water across a swampy piece of land, to the main road. We walked 1/2 mile to a dwelling, where I remained while my husband rode to Jackson with a messenger sent for physicians. I had opportunity to reflect upon the care God has for those who serve Him. What separated the train, leaving the car we were in back upon the track? I have been shown that an angel was sent to preserve us. At the home of Serenius Smith, who lived in West Jackson, Elder White found Abram Dodge, who secured a team. Then together they drove to the farmhouse and returned with Mrs. White, arriving at the home of Brother Smith at 2 o'clock in the morning. After breakfast, they visited the scene of the catastrophe and learned the cause of the wreck. At a grade crossing, a large ox had lain down on the track. The engine, which had no cow catcher, struck the ox and was thrown off the track. After running about 8 rods, it struck an immense oak stump. This caused the engine to turn over, and lying crosswise on the track caused the wreckage of the cars. As they looked at the overturned engine, the wrecked cars, then at the last 2 cars, in one of which Elder and Mrs. White had been riding, more than 100 feet from the last car in the wreckage, they said in their hearts, "God does hear prayer. He certainly sent His angels to uncouple those cars that His servants might escape unharmed." They were confirmed in this conviction when the brakeman testified that he did not uncouple the car and that no one was on the platform when it was done. How it was done was a complete mystery to the trainmen. There was no link or bolt broken, and the big bolt with its chain lay on the platform of the unwrecked car. This trip to Wisconsin proved to be encouraging. There they met in conference a number of new believers. "There is an ear to hear in the West, and a great call for publications," reported James White in the Review of July 4, 1854. The box of books that had been so providentially saved from the wreck was eagerly welcomed by the brethren. Over $150 worth were sold, and men were appointed to act as agents for the publications printed at the office in Rochester. They were also cheered to find other brethren with ability to assist in the preparation of suitable literature of present truth. J. H. Wagner, one of the leading members in the state, had prepared a pamphlet on the law of God, and they reported that other brethren in Wisconsin design to prepare works for the press soon. Late in June, Elder and Mrs. White reached their home in Rochester and entered into the experience of their last year in that city. On August 29, 1854, there was born to Ellen White a third son, to whom was given the name of William Clarence. After referring to this added responsibility, Mrs. White closes her brief record of this event with one trenchant sentence. "He took my mind somewhat from the troubles around me." The addition of a baby boy in the home was a source of pleasure to all members of the large family. Especially did Anna White, the invalid then within a few weeks of her death, take delight in seeing the baby every morning and in fondling him. The mother, fearful of the risk to the health of the infant, sought tactfully to get him away from the tubercular patient, so she would manage unobserved to give little Willie a pinch, upon which he would set up a lusty howl of protest, and then she could take him to another room to soothe and quiet him without offending his Aunt Anna. During the 80 years since that time, this son has shared many interesting experiences with his father and mother, and with the cause in which they were pioneers.